The day I was born, I am told, once Mum and Dad had headed off into the city to the Queen Victoria Hospital, the elder seven kids in the family lined up on the back lawn, three boys at one end and three girls at the other, with four-year-old Audrey, a bystander, and began to throw things at each other and argue loudly about whether I would be a boy or a girl. The boys said I must be a boy to even things up, and the girls said I must be another girl because girls are much nicer. There'd been boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, girl, and then me, so really Audrey was the one who should have been a boy to keep the pattern intact. We were Stan, 16, Grace, 14, Bill, 12, Myrtle, 11, Roy, 9, Nancy, 7, Audrey, 4, and me. Besides Dad and Mum, there was Grandma Mac, Dad's mother, who had married a second time to become Mrs. McMahon, but that husband had long since died. We lived in a large timber two-bedroom house in Melbourne suburb with a big backyard front and back with a large and very productive vegetable garden at one side and a huge shed we called the stable at the other. The shed contained Dad's workshop in the back corner and housed our horse and a dray and a jinka. The big back veranda on the house had been closed in at one side as a bedroom and with three beds. And beyond that, on another narrow veranda, there were canvas blinds to keep the weather out, and two more beds were there. They were for the five girls. Mum and Dad had the front bedroom and Grandma the next one, and the three boys shared a tent in the backyard. On the other side was the front room, which was only used when we had special visitors. It also contained the piano, which I learned to play from the time I was 6 until 16. In the centre of the house was a huge living room with a wood fire stove, an old gas stove on which only the top part worked, with three gas rings, its oven being where the cooking pots and baking trays were stored. On the other side of the big table was a sink bench with a cold tap over it, but no plumbing underneath. So the bucket underneath had to be emptied regularly after the sink was used. Behind Grandma's room was the bathroom. Again, only cold water. Next was the laundry with a wood-fired copper, and behind that, off the back veranda, was the toilet. In the space before the toilet door was a big wooden box, about 2 metres long and 1 metre high and wide. This section of the veranda was called the chaff place, because the box was used to store the chaff and other foods for the horse and for the chooks which lived in the chook house at the end of the garden. Eventually the front veranda was also closed in with canvas blinds and became my bedroom when I was 14. To me it was a magic place, the first time I'd ever had a space of my own. The only hot water we had was from the big kettle which sat constantly on the kitchen stove, and from the copper which was lit every Saturday so that everyone could have a bath, and on Monday to wash the clothes, sheets, towels, etc. When it was bath time, the first person would have a bath, and then another bucket of boiling water would be added for the second person, and so on, with another bucket added for each person. I can't remember which water we bathed in. I don't know whether I was first or last. If anyone was really mucky, they had to wash themselves first in a basin of water before they got into the bath. Mum believed that the best way to get really dry was to have one towel which took the worst off, then another dry one to finish off with. So the first person's second towel became the second person's first towel, and so on, with each of us having a new towel to finish off with. Then they all got boiled on the Monday. When Roy was a baby, Dad had built the house, with Mr. Zerby providing the land and materials. The arrangement was that we would pay him rent until the house was paid off. But the Great Depression intervened and the rent couldn't be paid, so Mr. Zerby said we could stay there but we would rent it permanently. He said that if he decided to sell it, we would have first option to buy. It's in East Kew, which then was an outer suburb of Melbourne, with paddocks at the bottom of the street and in the next street beyond ours. At the top of the street was a row of shops, and the tram ran through High Street out to North Baldwin. I remember when I was about 12 going into the city by myself on the tram, terrified that I wouldn't recognise a stop where I had to get off and be carried off to suburbs unknown on the other side of town. I had to meet Bill at the Flinders Street railway station and, of course, recognised it quite well. I was very proud of my brave endeavour. We were a very happy family, usually working well together on whatever had to be done. If two people began to argue loudly, there were a whole lot of other people who would tell them to shut up and to solve whatever the problem was. We were quite poor and all wore hand-me-downs, though Mum believed that shoes should not be shared, so we got new shoes. As our feet outgrew the shoes, Mum would cut the front upper off them so that our toes would hang out until it was too uncomfortable to walk that way when a new pair would be bought. Dad would hammer metal tips on the heels and toes so they wouldn't wear so fast. As the tips wore out and the heads of the tacks holding them, we had to be careful that the tip, which by then had a razor-sharp edge, didn't swing loose and cut our other ankle. I was born as the Depression was ending, but I heard of the things they'd had to do to stay alive in the previous years, with Dad out of work and on the dole. We had a magnificent quince tree in the garden, and I could never understand why I was the only person who would eat any of them. Mum used to make some quince jelly, but apart from that, they were left for me and any visitors who would accept them. And I learned that at one stage, for several weeks, there'd been absolutely nothing else to eat but quinces, and Mum had prepared them in every way she could think of, but after that, none of the family could face eating them. Dad used to go around the district collecting horse manure in huge bags on the back of our dray. Then he would go around the district selling them for sixpence a bag. People complained that with the bumping along the roads, the manure had settled in the bags and they were not quite full. So then it was Grace's job, at about age 13, to jump up and down in the bags to pack the manure in more firmly before Dad headed out with them. Grace never really got over the horror of that job. Dad would take the money to the Victorian markets and buy bulk vegetables and load the sacks onto his bike to ride home. Then he would take the individual cabbages and so on around the neighbours and sell the ones we couldn't use at cost price. So people were happy to get nice fresh stuff at less than they could buy in the shops. That way our family were able to afford more food for ourselves. Sometimes the dole people would bring second-hand clothes to us, and one day the bundle included some really nice girls' clothes that fitted Grace. When she next went to school, the kids all hooted at her, "Ah, you're wearing Dorothy's dress. She died last week of diphtheria." Poor Grace. Another time, the only shoes she had to wear to school were a pair of ladies' high-heeled sandals that were too big for her. But it was unthinkable to go barefoot, so off she went to be hooted at again.